Well, welcome everyone to the Elemental Awakening podcast. I got a very special guest today, Mr. Steve Beattie. Thanks for tuning in. If you like these episodes, please subscribe, comment, like, share with a friend, say hello, let me know where you're from. I really appreciate all your feedback and just really engaging with us. So thank you for that. And today we have Steve here, who was, I think, the second Wim Hof certified instructor in Canada.
That was the second one.
Second one after me. I held that. Yeah. That was very first thing that was ever the first in, I think. Well, for a long time. Anyways.
And I'm always the second.
Yeah, always the second. And he traveled halfway around the world to Australia to get a certification. I thought he was giving me a little more time, but it is an amazing community. All the instructors now, there's a bunch of them in Toronto anyways, and I really enjoy connecting with them. So we'll talk a bit about that. We'll talk about Wim Hof today. Steve's also a breathwork facilitator, instructor. He's someone I look up to when it comes to breathwork. He's very well-read, well-educated, well-practiced in all these things and more. So welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you for having me here. This is very exciting.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. In addition to that, me and Steve are working on a few interesting projects that we'll keep you updated on as well. So Steve, tell me a bit about yourself. You can start as early as you want and what drove you into this sort of
Well, I'm a geologist, obviously, so I say no more. That's how I got here.
Okay.
So I come from a very hard science background, where things are things, and worked in a, had an office job. I became a geologist because I wanted to be work in the outdoors. I was very much at home in the outdoors. I loved being in the outdoors, but I wanted a professional career in the outdoors. But it turned out to be an office job, and it became a computer job. And so I just, I got stuck in this office for the first, for my 20s, basically. I was working in an office, staring at a computer screen, and it was miserable. It was just the soul-sucking, miserable existence. I hated it. I hated every second of my life in my 20s. Had a good life. Made lots of money, went to restaurants, enjoyed it, but something missing. Something was really desperately missing from my life. And it was in 2001, September 12th, 2001, after that, September 11th. I had just come back from a charity bike ride where we rode our bikes from Montreal to Portland, Maine.
Wow.
And yeah, it was a great...
A long ride.
Yeah, it was a long ride. And it was fantastic. It was just this incredible ride. And I realized on that ride, I had a lot of time to think. I was alone. I was with thousands of people, but I was very much alone on this ride. And it was... During that, I realized that I had to make a change. I had to get out. I was so desperately unhappy with my life, and then suddenly, you know, buildings were falling down, and the world was ending, and all this terrible stuff started happening. Like, this is it. I'm out, and so I quit. But help that the company I was with was also going bankrupt at the time, so sort of
okay.
A little spur. But instead of going back into the industry, I retrained. I got into the wilderness industry, you know, wilderness guide. So then, in my 30s, I was a wilderness guide. I walked the woods and I took canoeing and hiking and camping and got to know all the rivers and lakes of Ontario and Quebec. It was beautiful and I loved it. And that was my life. I found what meant something to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then my wife and I were talking about having a family, so I came back and I went back to school again and racking up student debt. And I became a personal trainer. Because I love the physical aspect of being a wilderness guide. So I became this personal trainer, but I still had this very mechanical view of the world as a personal trainer. And that's what we were taught in school, was like muscles contract, arm bends. That's how the body works. So I became a personal trainer. I was quite good at it. And one of the things they taught us in personal training school was to stretch your clients at the end of a training session. I actually had a professor at school say it's a good way to blow off 10 minutes of a session. That's fraud. You can't do that. But you know, everybody did, so I pulled my client's leg in the air for them and put it down, and you know, I'd see them the next week and their range of motion hadn't changed one little bit. Nothing changed. I just blew off 10 minutes at the end of the session. But I had a couple clients who saw a huge change in their range of motion and their well-being and their strength, their mobility from stretching. Now why? Why does it work for some? For a very small group of people, but for most people, stretching was a complete waste of time. And then I discovered fascia. And I read this book called Anatomy Trains by Tom Myers. And it changed my view of the human body. It's a paradigm shift in the way I think. And suddenly this body wasn't this mechanical thing. It was this interconnected whole entity that all worked together. That if you know, if your feet aren't working, your arms don't bend. You know, everything was interconnected. And I took this deep dive into fascia and I became a fascial stretch therapist. I went back to school again and became a fascial stretch therapist with the Stretch to Win Institute out of Phoenix, Arizona. And just, I changed everything. The way I treated the body, the way I treated my clients, and I became a fascial stretch therapist. I started to work with fascia in the body. And it was when I was doing this fascial work with people that I was suddenly starting to feel something else with people. I'd be stretching them and they'd tear up on the table. Oh, what's going on? We don't have emotions. We're in a gym, don't do that. Or they start to laugh, or they become very talkative. And they were like releasing energy at me. What is going on? And then I started to feel it. I'd be moving their body around, stretching them on the table. And I would feel this rush of energy into my body. I'm like, what's going on? I don't know what this is. This does not fit my worldview. Mm-hmm. So working with fascia changed my view of the body, but now it's changing the very essence of my worldview of how things work. And so I started to take a deep dive into that and learning more about fascia and how it works in the body. And how
so in these schools, like Stretch to Win, do they talk any about that emotional or energetic component, or are they still a little bit more advanced on the mechanics of what the fascia does? Do they talk about the energetic body at all?
Some of them do, some of them don't. And the ones who did talk about it, some of my teachers who talked about it, I thought, whatever, that's not real, give me a break. And so I kind of gathered with the people who were kind of the hardcore personal trainers, the scientific people that needed like these real hardcore sort of
evidence-based
stuff. But there's lots of evidence-based stuff for this now. Mm-hmm. So much has changed in the past 10 years. But I very much gravitated towards the people who didn't believe this stuff.
Okay.
So that's where I was. But taking a step backwards, through this whole journey, this whole process, becoming a wilderness guide, becoming a fascial stretch therapist, I was a sponsored athlete, I did multi-day adventure racing, but I was becoming sick, and I didn't know why, because I was a personal trainer, I was a nutritionist, I did everything right, and I coached people how to be healthy, but I was getting sick. Every day I was getting a little bit more sick, my body ached, I couldn't digest food properly, I couldn't sleep properly, I was falling apart. And I'd make little changes, and that kind of drove a lot of my education. So I'd learn about this thing, about nutrition. I became a nutritionist to try and fix my nutrition. And it helped a little bit, but then it didn't help anymore. And so I learned about sleep and the importance of sleep and how to get a good night's sleep. And it worked for a little bit, but then it didn't work anymore. What is going on? And I kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And then I was in my early 40s, and I found myself lying in a hospital bed. And thinking, oh my God, this isn't right. I'm the healthy guy. And my whole body was inflamed. I just puffed right up. Everything hurt in my body. I could barely breathe. And my heart was in atrial fibrillation. Like it was just jumping around and quivering in my chest. And they're getting ready to shock me back into sinus rhythm in the hospital. They rolled the crash cart into the emergency room. Thinking, oh my God, this is real. This is happening. And it was right at that moment that everything went crazy in the emergency room of the hospital. You know, all the doctors and nurses were rushing around doing this and that, and they were wheeling in gurney after gurney of people who had just been in a bar fight. Yeah, the stab was bits of glass sticking to people. It was a Wednesday afternoon, by the way. It wasn't Friday night. And it was at that moment when I actually said out loud, I'm not sick. I'm not sick. My heart went back into sinus rhythm.
Well,
yeah, what's that? How'd that happen? And then that was the beginning. Oh, I had all these little hints, all these little peeks into something else, and I didn't understand what it was. But now I was sick and I had to heal. I was really sick. And I went through round after round after round of testing to figure out what's wrong with me. They finally gave me a diagnosis and the medicine to fix it. But it wasn't a real diagnosis. I had non-specific rheumatoid arthritis. That's not a thing. It's a collection of symptoms, but it's not a disease. but they had the medication for it. So I wanted to find something different. And a friend of mine said, hey, have you ever heard of Wim Hof? And I had. Years ago, I saw this documentary about this crazy guy running a marathon in the Arctic. In just shorts, barefoot, bare chested, minus 40 degrees, or whatever it was. Freezing cold. It was too cold.
Yeah, it was cold.
It was too cold to be in shorts. But he ran this marathon. That's amazing. So I watched the documentaries, I got the podcast, I watched more documentaries, YouTube videos. Didn't do it, just looked at it for months until finally I sat down in my living room and I listened to the recording again and I began the method. Over and over again, I took these breaths until finally I breathed out and I held my breath with no air. For as long as I could, for a long time. My body was buzzing. Looked at my stopwatch. Oh, my breath again. Right away. And I did three rounds of this, and immediately I felt better. And I wasn't in an inflammatory state. I just become used to the stiffness, this achiness in my body. Mm-hmm. And this first round of Wim Hof method, I was cured. Mm-hmm. We don't like to use the word cured. I felt better. All the symptoms just subsided in 20 minutes of breathing, like that. So I went on this deep dive of breathing and healing and feeling better and feeling better and feeling better. And I realized that all this stuff, yeah, it made me feel better. It taught me how to meditate again, which I kind of forgot what it was. And then when I went into the master module in Australia, it was a week-long deep dive into breathing and cold exposure, really bonding with my brothers and sisters in Australia. And it was on the last day of that journey where we did this long breath practice. And I got in the ice tub for the last time. And we were holding this intention for our week was, what is your blockage? What's stopping you from moving forward? Oh, blockage, I don't know. What blockage? I have no idea. This thing, I don't know. I don't know what it is. But that subconscious seed planted and is germinating all week. And I went into the ice water that last day. And when you go into the ice water, there's no hiding from ice water. It is like, get out. Right? You want to get it, it's cold. All the people I teach this method to, they all ask, when does it get easy? It doesn't get easy, it never gets easy. Ice water is always ice water. It's the righteous teacher. So I go in and I feel the shock of the cold, and then suddenly it's like, it felt like my brain was a Rubik's Cube. And it suddenly went click, and all the colors were lined up perfectly, and I saw my purpose in life. I saw everything I have to do, everything that I need to do in life. And then suddenly I had this rush of emotions through my body, and I burst into hysterical laughter and crying all at the same time. And it was the first time I cried in 32 years.
Oh.
That was my blockage. I had no emotions. I completely cut them off. I didn't want to deal with emotions. Mm-hmm. You know, be a big boy, don't cry. So my entire life, I went through life like that, completely disconnected from my emotions.
That's probably why you're really, because biased, or like when people talk about emotions, like, I don't want to go there, that's not
real. Yeah, 100%.
You're suppressing it in yourself.
So yeah.
Entertaining it that possibility.
It can't be real. I don't want it to be real. Yeah.
Can you trace that back to like childhood? Was that like something your parents would say, like, be a man, Steve?
Oh, very much. Yeah, I'm a good Protestant child. I was born in the UK. I was raised as an English kid. Yeah. You know, we don't stiff upper lip and all that.
Yeah.
So we don't want to deal with that kind of stuff at all. I was always told to be stoic. So I thought being stoic was to deny emotions, not observe emotions. So what the Wim Hof method has done, and my journey into breath work, which has gone way beyond the Wim Hof method now, it is a way to go deep within myself and observe my emotional state and to understand them and slowly peel away those layers over the past two and a half years where I've been on this deep dive, slowly peel away these layers to reveal what's deep inside the trauma that we go through in life that we, if you deny yourself emotions, you deny yourself the ability to process trauma in your life. And trauma doesn't have to be, you know, going through a war. You know, trauma can be just little things in your life that if you're not resolving that trauma, you are carrying that trauma with you forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why when you see on the news and you see people have gone through horrendous things and they can freely talk about it, talk about their experience, they process that trauma and they separate the emotional state from the memory. So now they can talk about it.
Well, that's the key. Right? That's the key right there, separating the emotion from the experience. Yeah. It just becomes something that happened versus something you're reliving every time you think about it.
Every single time, everything, it's like one little thing reminds you of that trauma.
There's triggers everywhere.
Back in it all the time. This trigger, that's what a trigger is. And then you can meet somebody who, you know, they've been through something that doesn't seem like they've been in a fender bender and their car got scratched.
Mm-hmm.
And they're waking up with cold sweats every night.
Yeah.
Because they can't process that trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Interesting. So what happened after that? So you had this breakthrough in the ice bath that you can feel emotions. Emotions are real. You have this experience, you're crying and laughing.
Yeah.
How did that feel?
I remember, scared, trying to resist it still. I was trying to resist it, but it was not going to be stopped. The floodgates were open. It was like, just coming out, just flooding out of me. Like it was 32 years of pent up emotion.
I can imagine.
Like that's not a small cry.
Yeah.
That is letting it all out. But I remember being embarrassed and like trying to hold it back, and then, you know, I'd sort of get it back and I was out of the tub, and then a friend of mine put his hand on my shoulder and it's like, blah! Again, as soon as that happened, there's just no holding back. I try and hold, and then I still feeling embarrassed that I have emotions. You know, I try and turn away, and I just took some quiet time to just let it flood out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, you know, I'm still embarrassed by the idea of emotions, which I guess in itself is embarrassment, I guess, is a secondary emotion.
I guess, now that you have the awareness, you have to go back and reprogram a subconscious mind, and that's some of the stuff that Tyson's been working on. So it's how does that embarrassment serve you? And then reprogramming that, because it's doing something to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing something to make your parents proud. It's doing something that you've been programmed that this is good. So subconscious mind is just trying to really work for you. You know, now you got to go back and repetitively tell it, like, look, it's okay to have emotions. I'm allowed to feel.
Exactly.
You know, it's a good thing to feel emotions. Let them be my guide, my teacher. And it's just really working on that, I think, going back to that time.
But even saying that, acknowledging that, that's still your conscious mind acknowledging it. And 95% of what we do is subconscious or unconscious doing that all the time. We don't think about how we get through our day. Mm-hmm. We just get through our day because it's sort of this deeper level of our mind. So it's getting that implanted into your mind. Like, it's one thing. And that's a big problem with a lot of self-help books and lectures and that kind of stuff. You hear it and you read it and you say it, but it's the conscious mind that's done that. It's not the subconscious reprogramming.
So the only way to really reprogram your subconscious mind is through repetition.
Yeah.
So most people do not want to put the work in. So they'll read a book once and then they'll leave it. Oh, I understand.
Yeah.
But if you're not repetitively reprogramming, so from my understanding, it's not only saying it, but tying an emotion to it, like gratitude or love or a higher vibrational emotion.
Mm-hmm.
As you're doing this practice on a daily basis, and then over time, you'll see that the trigger starts disappearing.
Exactly.
Like all the triggers that used to be a trigger, they start going away. It's go up. I don't have to be triggered by that. And for you, it was emotions. For someone else, it could be anything.
It could be anything.
I mean? Like body shame or imposter syndrome or who knows what. Like all these other things, and small things will trigger them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But when you reprogram the subconscious, whatever happened, like your upbringing, your dad telling you stiff upper lip, it's because of the thing he said.
Yeah.
And there's no more like attachment to that anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
Super interesting.
Yeah. And with the emotions being my block, I realized that these emotions are also the tool to help me heal from it. So I began a daily meditation on gratitude and heart love meditation. Every morning, I would do that. So I still do. It's been years now of doing this every single day and raising that vibrational energy in my heart. Our heart speaks more to our brain than our brain does to our heart. It's our heart that feels the emotions in our body and tells the brain this is what's going on. And then you can respond, you have to observe it. And so day after day after day, I raise that vibrational energy in my heart, and then I go deeper into that meditation and go into those places that have caused this trauma to understand, where is this? And so I go in with that strong, resilient, heart-centered position to heal.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump ahead a bit. We'll come back to your story. Have you ever tried any sort of psychedelic therapy to try to access some of those parts, like mushrooms, ayahuasca, anything like that?
I haven't
spoken a bit about it.
Yeah. I think it's spoken a bit. Yeah, we've spoken a bit. Well, yeah, so I haven't done ayahuasca. I used to feel a great need to do ayahuasca. I was always very drawn towards ayahuasca. But getting deeper and deeper and deeper into breath work, I go on such psychedelic journeys with just breath work now. When we go through a very rhythmic breath pattern, this is the science part coming in. when we go through this very, very deep rhythmic breath, we know that our ribs expand, contract, but our pelvis also expands and contracts a little bit. And that generates a little pump action of cerebral spinal fluid that goes up our spine, around our brain, and that creates a little bit of pressure and vibration on our pineal gland. And over time, these little calcium crystals decrystallize a little bit, so the space between them, they can vibrate and create a piezoelectric charge, which allows a release of DMT into the body, which is what ayahuasca is. Mm-hmm. So through breath work and going through...
Is this all theoretical now, what you're saying? Or is it, has it been proven anyway? Because I know there's a lot of debate around... I know Joe Dispenza talks a bit about what you just explained.
The heart math, Joe Dispenza, a few other people talk about it. The problem is we can't put people in these states and then cut their brain open and have a look.
Yeah.
They get very upset when you do that.
Yeah.
So, but people who have done DMT, ayahuasca, say it's a very similar experience. So it must be that. And we do know that the pineal gland is active during this breath exercise. We do know that there's brain activity around that area. It's brain waves active around the pineal gland. And we do know the experience is similar to the DMT trip. So that all looks like we can see the charge. So we can see the piezoelectric charge developing in the body. So these are measured and quantifiable.
Does the pineal gland also create melatonin?
It does. DMT is at the end of the melatonin cycle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so serotonin turns to melatonin, turns to a few other things, and finally into DMT.
Because I remember reading this somewhere, but structurally, DMT or melatonin minus carbon dioxide is DMT.
Yeah.
So if you're expelling all this CO2, maybe the body's pulling the CO2 from the melatonin and turning it into DMT. That's just my own theory.
You could be on
something there. And something else that me and a couple friends, my friend Corey, who I'm going to have on this podcast as well, and my other friend Chris, now that cannabis is legal in Canada, people have been doing cannabis-infused breath work. Mm-hmm. And from some of the research, it states that cannabis can increase melatonin production up to like 3,000% and up.
Yeah, so I've done a lot of that.
All of this melatonin,
yeah.
And if melatonin can convert to DMT, but now you're creating an environment where, mm-hmm. you know, maybe there's more reactivity to create that based on what you're creating through the breath. It's like maybe that can.
So what I find with cannabis use and breath work is that the post breath work dream-like surreal state that lasts for a few minutes, lasts for a very long time, like hours. I stay in that, it feels like my prefrontal cortex is offline for a very long time. I'm in this deep sort of flow state, dreamlike experience. You know when you first wake, when you've just had a dream,
yeah,
and you wake up, you feel aware, what's going on? I stay in that state for a very long time.
Yeah, I think we're gonna have to do some experimentation. There's a few people doing it in Toronto now, but you know, I want to learn from them, but I also want to like use some of my own intuition. Yeah. And I'm sure you got a few tricks up your sleeve that we can really play around with.
That is my favorite way to use I know it's cannabis, a psychedelic technically. It certainly enhances the psychedelic effect.
I think if you can turn it into a psychedelic, yes. You know, like if it's giving you that, you know, how do you define a psychedelic? You know, it's something that creates an altered state of consciousness that can be visual or change like auditory. So if you're activating DMT through cannabis,
we're also activating the cannabinoid receptors.
So yeah, I was just about to say that. So they, who was it? Even just yesterday I was talking about how there were five, my friend Chris mentioned it, there were five things that were important to create an altered state of consciousness naturally. And one of it was you know, stimulating the vagus nerve. There's a few other ones. But one of them was activating the endocannabinoid system in the body. And that was a key. So now if you're using marijuana to sort of activate it or enhance it or stimulate it, then it just makes sense, right? Yeah. But breath work can stimulate it as well.
Yes, it can, especially when you combine in the early part of that breath work, if you go through a very deep body awareness meditation, that's also going to activate the part where the cannabinoid receptors are in that, I believe the periaqueductal gray area is where our proprioception is, and that's where you activate during that meditation, and that's where you're going to experience the endocannabinoids as well. So you're getting an enhanced reaction there, and then you're also increasing the melatonin by 3,000%, you said?
Some of the studies I saw was 3,000, 4,000%. So it's big. So it's not gonna, just a little bit.
Yeah, so that's adding to all that stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. I've tried it too on both mushrooms and LSD.
Okay.
As well. Yeah.
And?
During the breath holds in this, when you go into the oxygen deficit, that's when I feel like I'm getting like the psychedelic part of it, and I start to see a lot of imagery behind my eyes. Indeed, in my mind, my third eye, I see a lot of the fractals and the spirals, and every culture has their own perception of what's happening during that. So in Eastern traditions, you see the lotus flower. In West Africa, they have a spider god, and you'll often see like a spider web pattern, but it's the same image. Mm-hmm. A couple weeks ago, I saw Celtic crosswork, Celtic knotwork in that image. But again, it's the same image of knots and spirals and stuff. It enhances that a lot on LSD. It really enhanced that imagery.
Do you think it's all these psychedelics are bringing you to the same place?
I think so.
Yeah.
And these psychedelics work because we have the receptors in us.
Yeah, that's what I find most intriguing. Like, if we weren't supposed to interact with them, then they wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. You know,
in that or it just happens that we interact with them because we can create this stuff ourselves.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. That's a really good point as well. So what kind of doses? Is it like microdosing them?
Doses? Yeah, both the mushrooms and LSD was only microdosing.
Just give yourself a little boost.
Just a little bit. And even like with the cannabis, I just don't like the feeling of being high.
Too high, yeah.
Yeah. So it's always a small amount. And then the journey comes from within. That's why I like breath work. I think our body will only ever give us what we're able to handle. Hmm. If we go, and a lot of fantastic work has been done around ayahuasca and iboga and LSD and mushrooms, also just have a lot of fantastic work, very important work. But it's an external source. And so I think if you are dealing with a lot of internal turmoil, trauma issues, that you're not ready to deal with all of it yet, breath work allows it to trickle out, and you dose yourself a little bit each time.
It's a great way to prepare yourself for an ayahuasca ceremony. Just open the gates a little bit.
Yeah. If you go in straight into an ayahuasca ceremony, you've done no groundwork, that's just going to be too much. For a lot of people,
it'll be definitely harder. The problem is, most people don't want to put in the work. Mm-hmm. They see ayahuasca as another pill they can take that's going to be one time. And what happens most times is that you get that reset, but you don't do any integration after. You end up going back, you backtrack. You may be good for a month, two months, 6 months. Yeah. If you're not doing any work, changing your lifestyle, taking any of the advice that came to you in the journey, you know, you're going to go right back. Yeah. So that's why I think a breathwork practice, I always tell people, meditation breathwork is the best. Two of the simplest, easiest, most effective tools to add that's going to help make long-term change.
I've met two or three people now who tell me that they do an ayahuasca ceremony every 3 or 4 months. On what aren't you getting out of it the first once or twice or three times maybe? But they're going back again. And again,
it depends why they're going. If they're going to heal, then they're not learning from it. Some people, it's just so interesting. Like for me personally, like now that I go teach arrhythmia 3 times a year, every time I'm there, I take advantage. Mm-hmm. So I know some people who, including myself, who will go and do 3 or 4 times a year. Depends why they're going. If people, you know, some people have a lot of trauma, so they're continuing to sort of heal and work on that. But other people are doing it because they don't do the work in between. They just keep.
Yeah, and those are the people I'm referring to, yeah. Where it seems like it's just an alternative to the addiction they already had.
Yeah.
You know, they've given up this thing, whatever it was. Addiction doesn't mean, you know, shooting heroin in the back alley, you know, shopping, work, exercise, they're all addictions. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times people give up that part of their trauma and replace it with doing ayahuasca all the time.
Yeah.
Instead, without doing any of the work.
Yeah, and personally, like I said, I go teach 3 times a year at Rhythmia. I like to go there and I'm going to more self-exploratory mode. Like I ask to learn about the universe, about life.
Yeah.
And they can show you these interesting things, but so can breathwork. You know, I've had some amazing, I just find that I'm usually facilitating breathwork, so I don't have as much opportunity to go in. I do my Wim Hof breathing like every morning. That's usually my routine. Right now it's nice outside, so I've got the tub in the backyard, so nice and cold. Mm-hmm. So I can get the natural cold dip without having to create, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of mess with ice and stuff like that. But some of the deeper dives, it's hard sometimes for me to find discipline to breathe by myself for 45 minutes.
That's a big challenge. I actually recorded myself guiding a class, then I used that to guide me.
And how'd that work?
It's fine. It's once I got over the idea that it's me guiding me, it's okay. But it's so much better being guided by someone
Absolutely.
Else. A big part of doing this breath, or doing this journey, or meditating at all, is to let go of that prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. that thing that's busy brain.
You're thinking about
how many breaths, how long I'm going to breathe for, how long I'm going to hold my breath for. And the first view of that was actually in the early days when I was doing the Wim Hof method. Everybody wants to time how long they can hold their breath for. How long can you hold your breath? So I'd have my stopwatch and I'd do the breath work and hold my breath. And as soon as I looked at my clock, it was like, I have to breathe. Didn't matter how long it was, as soon as I looked. And I realized like right away that, you know, this has nothing to do with how long I can hold my breath. It's everything to do with what's going on in there. So I just put it away and I felt my breath. Mm-hmm. And so that, again, was the next stepping stone in that journey, was learning to feel and to observe what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I had a really, really interesting thing happen about a month ago. I was getting ready to do a big lecture for StoaCon in Toronto. And I was doing my breathing and my breath holds. And I like to just feel where that breath is emanating from. Where do I need to take a breath? For those of you who don't do the Wim Hof method, when you see how far you can swim underwater, you take a big breath and you hold your breath, it feels like your lungs are burning and you have to breathe. When you exhale and hold, it's not like that at all. Your lungs aren't burning. This desire to breathe comes from someplace else. And for me, it was always, I recognized that it was an emotional thing. I always felt like my heart wanted to breathe. And I just thought that was how the breath hold felt when you do this style of work. Mm. But the day before I was doing this big lecture, I needed to breathe in my throat. Hmm. That's where I felt that need to breathe. And so I started to really pay attention to where I was breathing, where I needed to breathe, and I would feel it. Sometimes it would be like the solar plexus, sometimes more in the sacrum, sometimes like in my head, I need to breathe. Wait a second, it's those things, it's the chakras in the body. So I had a look at that, what do each of these chakras mean, and I thought, oh. So there's this old emotional block, this old I'm still struggling, it's still there, still part of me. And that's why I always feel that. But sometimes it's a little lower down, sometimes it's in the solar plexus. And this one time it was in my throat, my voice, are they gonna hear me? And I was on stage with a bunch of professors. So talk about imposter syndrome. it was crazy. So now when I teach breath work, I really have people through those first couple rounds just to pay attention to where that need to breathe is coming from. Mm-hmm. And be open to the conversation you're gonna have with your body, the knowledge your body has.
Yeah, I do the same too. It's just, I tell people, when you feel tension in every body, pain or frustration, maybe that part of your body is trying to get your attention, to put some awareness there, because every part of your body has a significance. It has meaning. You hold emotions in your body, and there's different like schools of thought, like German medicine, and I think Louise Hay, they talk about how each part of your body signifies something. Mm-hmm. Like lower back is like stability, financial stability, and stuff like that. And there's a left side of your body, the right side of your body, which, you know, signifies your mother, which signifies your father. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. Some people have really, really done a good job at mapping them out, and you see like, wow, you know, it's super interesting. So then when I get an injury somewhere, it's like, okay, what does that really mean? And then, you know, do I believe in that? And then does it make sense?
Or you actually just drop something on your foot.
Yeah. Yeah, but they even say that. That whole series of events is bringing awareness to that thing in your life because you're not doing it. So subconsciously, you're hurting yourself to sort of like, hey, we need some attention here.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, like a broken hand, a broken arm, or what it means in your life when you really start paying attention. Because most people are running on autopilot. Their subconscious mind is running the show consciously. They're just going through the motions of life and they have no awareness. And that's, you know, when I say like, once you become more aware, you see like even opportunities come, like different things are gonna start popping out and you're gonna be drawn more to be able to follow your intuition. Mm-hmm. If too much noise going on, you can't follow that because you're not aware of anything. You're just rolling the hamster wheel in the head.
Yeah. And we find things to bring more noise into our lives.
Sometimes if...
The average person is looking to be busy.
Why do you think that is?
Well, to drown out what's going on.
Distract themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just started realizing that about myself. And I was okay, we need to slow down. What am I distracting myself from?
Yeah.
What's the void I'm trying to fill here? Mm-hmm. You know. So it's super interesting. So I guess coming back to your story, so you had this breakthrough. You went on, you did some more practice, and then what are you doing now? So you're.
So I'm helping people go on the same journey that I went on. So I do a lot of. I teach a daily breath class, which is just to the public. But on one-on-one, I take people who, it started off taking people who had physical pain in their body. They had chronic pain, whatever it was. And I noticed this before I went on my own journey, I would notice that people would come to me and they have a bum shoulder that's hurt them for, you know, 10 years. And I would ask them where that pain is. Like, can you point to the pain in your shoulder? And they would actually literally look and think, oh, well, it's my shoulder. Well, but what part of your shoulder? What's in there? Can you touch where the pain is? And they can't. They actually don't have a location of the trauma, the pain itself, just that it hurts. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a real injury. It may have started off as a real injury, but there's no injury there now. And so I do my manual therapy of fascial stretch therapy and help bring a range of motion back to it and awareness. When we do fascial mobility, we increase proprioception, body awareness of that area. And when I was doing that, a lot of these people would have an emotional release. Mm. When we released and mobilized chronic pain areas, they would have a release, an emotional release. And then the pain was gone. And often stayed gone completely. Mm-hmm. They resolved it. I don't understand what's going on. I understand now what's going on. So now I take people who have this kind of chronic pain and we peel away some of the layers, but with that fascial mobility work that brings proprioception, now we can also use breath work to go deeper within and build a greater body awareness and then go deeper into the mind with breath work to help to process those emotions that are being released in the body. Mm-hmm. We have neuropeptides is the molecule of emotion. Every emotion you have, you release neuropeptides. And if it's a traumatic event, you may store that in your body because you're not ready to deal with it. In my case, I have 32 years of neuropeptides stored up that came flooding out in a big tidal wave of emotion. But so we use breath work, and then I take them into a heart meditation to bring awareness to the emotional state of the heart so that the heart can now send that signal to the brain. Mm-hmm. But because we've done this deep breath work, and I've taken them into this low alpha state or even a theta wave, dreamy, hypnotic state where their subconscious is very much close to the surface, and I can talk to the subconscious. Mm-hmm. And they can process this information, this material, this communication that the body has given them, comes to the surface. And it allows them to release and move forward and get over these events, mm-hmm. whatever it might be.
Yeah, a lot of similarities into sort of breath work that mm-hmm. I've also developed. You know, start off with some Wim Hof breathing and just really pushed it a little bit to get people into that state. And then, you know, it's just really engaging with, you know, the intelligence of the heart, getting to those space of gratitude, love, mm-hmm. joy, forgiveness, and it's super powerful. Like, I have people that are like, that's the first time I felt my heart like really buzzing with love, or first time I was able to connect with my inner child, or first, like, so many first times. Even just last night, it's like it was just so amazing. And you know, I realized when you talk about fulfillment earlier, like helping to facilitate those kind of experiences for people and seeing like the effect it has on them is the most fulfilling thing in the world. Like, you couldn't pay me enough money to get that feeling. Like, yeah, I'd like to get paid $10,000 to do it.
It'd
be great, but I'm not going to get that same feeling getting paid $10,000 to do just anything, whereas, you know, just doing this, which I really don't get paid much to do, but there's such a fulfillment aspect to it.
Yeah.
You know, where people are just, like, grateful, and they feel this change, and that's so amazing.
I have a number of people who just come to my class every day, and they do it because they say they just feel good all day long. Mm-hmm. And they know, they recognize that when they feel good, everybody they talk to also feels good after that. And they go and get a coffee from Starbucks. You know, the person behind the counter now feels good because...
Well, because you give off this...
You give off heart waves. And we can do that. We can measure. When we measure brain waves and heart waves and stuff, we don't put probes inside the body. We measure the heart outside the body.
Yeah, I think it's like 27 feet. I can give off a...
Oh, yeah. And perhaps further.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we don't know.
We don't know. And same thing with brain waves. Mm-hmm. You know, the probes aren't inside the brain, they're on the scalp, they're outside the brain. Mm-hmm. Right? Our brain waves are out here, our heart is way out here, it's pulsing away from us all the time. And so when you're just aware of that and know that when you raise that vibrational energy of love and gratitude and joy and just feel that in your heart, when you walk into the coffee shop and that person behind the counter just dealt with the most miserable piece of crap person in their life, and you come in with love, you can see the change on their face immediately. And we always talk about, you know when the dark cloud walks in, you know, that very, very negative person walks into a room behind you, and then you feel it. You can feel the same thing when somebody who's just full of love and joy and gratitude, when they walk in, you feel that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's move on to some random questions now. Well, I guess just to wrap up your story, you know, this is Elemental Awakening. So was there a particular moment in your life, would you say, was the major shift? Was it in that ice bath? Was it, like, what was that awakening moment where your whole life sort of shifted?
It was that moment in the bath when the floodgates opened and it came out. And I, like, that was the last day. I went back to Melbourne, Australia, and stayed another 2 days there, but I didn't actually leave the hotel. I just stayed. I couldn't deal with it. I couldn't deal with people. Just
so much emotion.
Well, I just felt like just numb, almost. Like I had, I used to suppress my emotions, but it was the day or two after that, I had no emotions. Like it was just shut off. And then it began to reboot. And which was, so it's like these weird bursts of emotion and giggling fits and stuff would start to happen for a few days. When I came back to Canada, that's a long flight, by the way. When I came back to Canada, my wife picked me up at the airport, and I hadn't seen her for, you know, almost 2 weeks. And she didn't come running up to me and throw her arms around, "Oh, I missed you," or it wasn't, she saw me from, you know, 10 feet away and said, "You've changed." Those are the first words. "You've changed." I said, "You're right, I have." So that was the defining.
Wow.
This was old Steve. This happened. Now it's this Steve.
Okay.
And it's been like it 4. Was 4. Like 0. Yeah, like a complete change. It was the gradual build up, and then break that off, sever it. And now it's this.
Nice.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's been a fascinating journey. That was just over 2 years ago. It was like every day. It's like what's happening now, what's happening today, what am I feeling today, how deep can I go today, what's my body going to tell me, what's this journey going to be today?
Interesting. So we'll jump to spirituality then, because this seems like some sort of spiritual, could be classified as spiritual experience. Growing up Protestant, do you now believe in God? Has it changed your perception of what God could be? All this breathwork practice brings these altered states, do you think those are just some chemical things that are going on? Do you think you're reaching some higher...
So I think it was Sam Harris who coined the term spiritual atheist.
Okay.
I would definitely put myself in the category of spiritual atheist.
What does that mean exactly?
So I was a strident atheist.
Strident atheist?
Yeah, I looked down.
Not just an atheist.
No, I looked down on people who were not also atheists. Like, how could you believe in such nonsense? Fairy tales, unicorns, they're not real. So I was very much that kind of atheist, like the Richard Dawkins atheist. In fact, I love the book, The God Delusion. Still do. But as a wilderness guide, as somebody who always loved being in the woods, who wanted to be in the outdoors, I was always very connected mm-hmm. with nature. I always felt very much at home. I felt the vibe of nature. So even when I was this strident atheist, I still felt nature. Mm-hmm. Didn't know what I felt, but I felt nature. Now, in the past couple of years, I've really been exploring what consciousness is and where consciousness sits in the body or outside the body. What are we? We're not just this physical self. Obviously, we're not this physical self because we feel, we measure ourselves outside of our body. So there's definitely an energetic connection. Consciousness sits somewhere within that matter, within that energy. And there's an emerging theory, it's called pan-consciousness, I think it's called, where consciousness is in everything. It's in the vibrational state of atoms is where consciousness is found. So this cup, you know, it has atoms in it. It doesn't have a lot of stuff going on, though. So it's only a little bit conscious. But as a more complex body with lots of stuff going on, we're highly conscious. Mm-hmm. So everything is conscious in some level.
And you think that consciousness represents some sort of God that's saying there's more to this than just us?
But the problem I have with God, I'm not talking about the biblical God.
Yeah, like some
the problem with the biblical God, I've got a list, but the idea of a supreme being, a supreme consciousness, I don't know why we have to have such a thing. Like what, that doesn't serve
anything. Well, something that put all this into motion, something that created everything.
Then what created that? Right, you can always keep going back to what created that.
Am I diving into an argument with an atheist that I'm not prepared for? Maybe, because it seems like I get all the rebuttals.
But saying, I was thinking about this just the other day, actually. The idea that, you know, this coffee cup is only a little bit conscious. If I tear this coffee cup in half, it's paper. If I tear this coffee cup in half, is it now equally, is it just half of what it was? Or are they equal consciousness? No, are we just fragments of a greater consciousness? No, the Big Bang, which, you know, we know that that's how the universe came into being. I'm pretty sure.
Theory.
Was it a sudden fracturing of consciousness?
Could.
Was there one solid consciousness at one point that fractured into billions and billions and billions and billions of lesser and lesser and lesser consciousness? Mm-hmm. And we are just one little fragment of that consciousness.
It's quite possible.
And when we release our corporeal selves, if our consciousness exists in that energy state, we know that energy is preserved. You know, you can't get rid of energy. Energy will always exist. So if our consciousness, as this pan-consciousness theory goes, it's in that vibrational state or the energy state of atoms, that doesn't disappear. When we die, we don't, you know, our atoms don't cease to exist.
Mm-hmm.
So the energy is still there. Does that consciousness exist? Does it go back into a broader field of consciousness? Mm-hmm. Does it fall into the conscious, like the earth must be very conscious?
So you think, from your perspective now, let's just simplify this a bit. Do you think Steve's has a soul that will leave this physical body and still exist beyond this experience right now?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
Okay. Has your unknowingness changed at all since your experience with breath? Where before you might have been absolutely not, or is the atheist perspective is we don't have any idea, or it's like it ends here and that's it.
Well, as an atheist, it stopped.
So now it's just a possibility that I don't know.
Yeah, but that still classifies as atheist. But what I will say is I realize I know even less all the time.
Okay.
That the more I experience the unknown through breath work. And the psychedelic effects of breath work and the expansiveness of my consciousness through breath work. I feel myself growing. I feel myself, I see images and people, and I feel myself expanding and connecting to greater things. Mm-hmm. And I get, I call it the download. I'm sure there's a term for it in different traditions. But about an hour after my breath work, I get the download of information into me. And it's my consciousness, or my subconscious, connecting with my consciousness. And so I write. I open my journal, I just start to write. I have no idea. I just start writing. And it's my subconscious is doing the writing. And I read it as it's coming out of my hand. And I'm like, wow, this is interesting. And just see what comes out. Or I draw a picture of images that come to my mind. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know what consciousness is. I don't see a reason to have a God other than the idea that we can't understand how it could have happened, so therefore God did it. I don't buy that. That, from the old atheist days, that is called the God of the gaps.
Okay.
I don't know, there's a gap in knowledge, so therefore God did it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we fill in those gaps all the time. We go deeper and deeper into, like, we didn't know how thunder happened, so God made thunder happen. Mm-hmm. Right, well, we know that that's just weather, we know that.
Yeah,
so we don't understand where we
are changing now. Like, I think the Old Testament, there's an interesting author right now who is a translator, and he was actually hired by the Vatican, that is now saying that a lot of translations were very wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that he's saying is like, listen, this is not my opinion. This is not my theory. This is my job is to translate mm-hmm. and tell you how I interpret these writings. And the writings are about how the Earth is like a DNA pool from some other intelligent civilization that planted us here, that to preserve this DNA, and it's super interesting. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily mean God exists, though. It just starts to explain what we believe in the Bible and how that can be interpreted.
Yeah. Well, the Bible is a problematic text. You know, it's a translation of a translation of a translation of a translation of an oral story told thousands of years.
Yeah, but there's a lot in there that they. What was the reasoning behind the Bible? It was more like a record keeping thing so that people could understand, and it was also, from what I understand, it's like tips on how to sort of like ascend, and then the church sort of just like changed that into like their own
controlling
sort of mechanism.
But anyway, the fact that there is a version of the Bible would be a problem right there, right? It's a King James version.
Branded it.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on from that. Let's talk about basically two other questions for you. What's the next thing you're curious about learning about? Because I know you're fascinated with learning, you're always expanding your toolkit. Is there something on the radar that's something you really want to deep dive into next?
Well, your idea where you go to Rhythmia every year, you do the ayahuasca journey to experience a greater understanding of your own consciousness and your soul, your connectedness. I'm very much interested in learning where my consciousness is and what it's capable of and how to connect. If consciousness is in that vibrational state of energy, and I am energy and I vibrate, I want to be able to change my vibrational state so that I can communicate with things we can't normally communicate, like a plant.
Mm-hmm.
We know that plants vibrate and have energy, and so perhaps, based on this theory, also consciousness.
Well, have you heard of Cleve Baxter? He was a polygraph specialist.
Yes.
He did all these tests on plants, and just by thinking about burning a plant, it would send a response on the polygraph detector. So there's got to be consciousness in there if it can.
If it knows that. Yeah.
If it knows that you're thinking that you're going to burn it.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna burn you, I promise.
We're going to love you.
Give me some water.
We're going to love you this leaf. Ginger tea.
There you go. That's
fine. Yeah. Might not like ginger. Sorry. Burning it with ginger. I think that's kind of where.
And how would you go about doing that? Like, what would be that process for you?
Well, I'm coming back around. I moved away from the idea of the ayahuasca journey because I felt my healing had to come from within. Still, I've healed for the most part. So the next part, I wonder if I can explore deeper in psychedelics and instead of microdosing, maybe do a greater dose and go deeper into that side of things and see how that changes my own perception and consciousness, and so there's that. That's sort of my personal journey
that
I want to do, and I want to take. And the more I learn about myself and this journey and how to heal in different modalities of taking people through breathwork and meditation, I'm always open to learning these ideas so that I can help other people. Because I've taken somebody through a breathwork, and it's like they do it, and they look at me and go, "Now what?" Well, okay, but didn't you? You're not ready for that, or the way I gave it to you was not for you.
You couldn't
do that. So always expanding my toolkit on how to deliver this work to other people.
Amazing. Okay, so more of your day-to-day, is there any like apps or technology that you really feel is a game changer for you that you've included that helps your day-to-day routine or anything about like the things that you're into?
Not really. The biggest thing I do with my breath work is listen to music. What I do, I listen to very rhythmic tribal music to make myself, when I can let go of thinking about breathing, I'll still continue to breathe in a rhythm that I want to breathe in. Mm-hmm. So that's really the only tool I use. Other than that, I don't use any tools. I'm very much a digital detox kind of person. I walk in the woods barefoot without my cell phone.
Cool.
Yeah,
I'm actually reading a book right now called Deep Work by Cal Newport. And he talks a lot about like ditching social media and getting away from a lot of that stuff because it actually, I guess, subtracts or detracts from our focus. So we're not able to focus as deeply on things because we're always distracted, always reaching for that phone, always going to that app.
So they say now we have the attention span of a fruit fly.
Wow.
Yeah. 3 seconds.
3 seconds. That's crazy. Yeah.
We need to get that fixed. Check my media. Check my email.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We touched on a lot of different things. Maybe we just close with, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wish that I would have asked you about?
That I wish you asked me about? No, I think we covered a lot of that. Can't think of anything offhand.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So what's one thing you're grateful for today?
I'm grateful for you, Gio. No, I mean that from my heart. I do. I don't mean that to be flippant, but I love the time you take to understand people and to connect with people. And I find that an inspiration. Mm. I think it's important. Mm-hmm. People don't connect with people. They don't spend time to listen to what they want. They just say, this is what you need. Mm-hmm. And you're the opposite of that. You really listen and connect with people on a very deep level. So I'm very, very grateful for you and the friendship that we've developed.
I appreciate that.
As I stalked you through the Wim Hof world.
Well, I knew we were going to be really good friends after we both ended up in New York at the same
breakfast events,
but we didn't know either of us were going. And I saw you post on social media that you just landed in New York. It was like an update or something. And I was just like, oh, Steve, you must be here for the breath work.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. Okay, cool. So, yeah, that pretty much wraps it up. So, if people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to reach you? I know you're going to be working. We're going to be working together on some elemental lifestyle programs. So, I'll have all your information on our website. Anything specific?
So, my website is breathinginnature.com. And then my email and everything is on breathinginnature.com. But I'm also coming out on an app, the 5 a.m. Club app is coming out. By the time this goes live, it's probably going to be live. So my meditations and some videos with elementals going to be on there, talking about breath work and meditation. So the 5 a.m. Club app is going to be a big channel to reach out to me. And then in the social medias, Breathing in Nature on Instagram, I'm pretty active on there. Trying to be active in Facebook, but I'm not. So yeah, Instagram, website, cool. Email. Yeah.
So check them out. Stay tuned. We're gonna put some links also to some of these apps below in the description, and we're also gonna have some cool courses on Elemental Awakening for you guys to check out. So
yeah, it's gonna be great.
Thank you so much, Steve, for taking the time to hang out here today. We're about to record some of these videos right after this, so I'm excited about that. And thank you guys for tuning in. Please like, subscribe, follow, share. Just engage in some way with us. We know you're out there. And follow us on Instagram, YouTube, or Facebook as well. Have an awesome day, guys. Thank you, and we'll see you soon.
Great. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk.